Before I get into the sermon itself, I want to read a poem by the late Rick Maston. Rick probably wrote this, sometime in the late 1990s, shortly after he got a diagnosis of prostate cancer. He passed away about 4 years ago. This is from a collection of his poems called Parallel Journeys. There's nothing more I can do for you. The urologist closes my file. I'm sending you to Dr. Hasdorf, an oncologist. Another way of saying, go home and get your affairs in order, bird brain. I become a card-carrying member of a local prostate cancer support group, although to my untutored ear, all that medical jargon made it seem like my fellow survivors were talking in tongues. During this period, I also went online to see what could be found out about the deadly adversary I was facing. One day, because of dumb luck and a benevolent search engine, I scramble up on the PCRI site, Prostate Cancer Research Institute. But on-screen printed matter is impossible for me to decipher, and as I was preparing to surf away, I noticed that PCRI had a helpline phone number. I dialed it, fully expecting a recorded message to inform me about what books to read and what websites to visit. But surprisingly, a live human voice responded. For an hour and a half, this anonymous Good Samaritan calmly talked me down, slowed me down, until my own philosophy of life could catch up and begin to see me through. Once again, I remembered that the height of my highest high is in direct proportion to the depth of my lowest low. And looking at it this way, there are wonderful times ahead. It has always been in crisis where we find the opportunity to change and grow. The human presence at the other end of the line kept me talking until I remembered everything I know. As Black Elk says, where the easy way is crossed by the path of difficulty, mark a holy place. This happened several years ago during a sabbatical I was taking in early 2004. I gave a presentation from what was then a work in progress book on the Beat Generation I was working on. I did it at an independent bookstore in Charleston, West Virginia, where I just happened to have a good contact. Yeah. Among those who showed up for this thing was this one guy, and he sat in the back of the room the whole time. He looked vaguely familiar, but I couldn't quite place him. He seemed a little detached from the whole event and didn't take part in the conversation I got going with the other attendees. It was more like he was sitting there in the back waiting for me to finish, which turned out to be exactly the case. After most of those in attendance left and I was gathering up my materials, he approached and extended his hand and asked if I remembered him. It took a couple seconds and then it clicked. He was an old high school classmate. The best either of us could remember the last time we'd seen each other was when we were in college. His name was Dave Walker. He and I were part of a circle of guys who hung out together during high school, sort of like those guys in the cast of Diner, for those of you who have seen that movie. We didn't get into some of the same kinds of things that those characters in Diner did, but it was a similar kind of camaraderie. Well, Dave stayed in the Charleston area, became a medical doctor and then a psychiatrist. He's taken on the role of trying to keep the St. Albans High School class of 1963 in touch with one another and been one of the guiding forces behind those once every 10-year reunions our class has. I've never been able to make those. For some reason, they schedule them, I think, like the second weekend in September, which is when we're kicking off another church year, so I kind of got other things going on up here. But our 50th anniversary is coming up next year, September 2013. Who knows? Maybe I'll be able to take in that one. Well, Dave had seen a little notice in the local paper about my being at the bookstore and decided he'd come down. We ended up going to a little coffee shop ice cream parlor across the street, and he caught me up on many of our once-upon-a-time classmates. You know, it was one of those who's doing what, where type of conversations. In many ways, it was reminiscent of the song you just heard Dan sing. You know, Helen is a hostess. Frank works at the mill. Janet teaches grade school. Probably always will. Bob works for the city, Jackson Lab Research, Peggy plays the organ at the Presbyterian Church. I'm going to come back to that song a little bit later. I doubt that any of us in my high school class fully knew the kind of world we were standing on. We're standing on the verge of in the spring of 1963. I've already did a sermon about a month or so ago on how my life and worldview and ministry were shaped by many of the tumultuous and momentous events of the 1960s. I'm not going to revisit all that now. I know, as I did share a few weeks ago, my life was significantly shaped and altered by those times. I still do wonder when I think about it if that was the case for some of the others in my class. But we had little idea, in fact, we had no idea, of the social and political and cultural hand that was just about to be dealt us in the spring of 63. I am curious as to how others in my class were affected by that hand, or if they were affected at all. I make no value judgments here, I just wonder. Did they live the kinds of lives they would have more or less lived anyway, even without the tumultuousness of the years that followed our graduation? Or did those years deal for them a hand they felt in some way the need or the calling to play out, which was the case with me? Well, if I make it to that 50th year reunion, maybe I'll ask around and find out. And there is a more philosophical issue. Maybe it's a religious and spiritual matter as well behind these kinds of wonderings on my part. I know you're not hearing it for the first time today, but I'll raise it anyway as it's an issue worth revisiting from time to time. Been on my mind of late at this point in my life. How much of our lives are shaped by the events that are visited upon us? And conversely, to what extent do we choose our own destinies and directions? Now, I know when I put it that way, I'm presenting a false dichotomy. It's some of both, of course, because the question doesn't break neatly and cleanly along either or lines. Our lives, in other words, are an ongoing process of both our acting and our being acted upon. And they're too often overlapped, they spill into one another. So maybe a better, more realistic way to frame the question then is to ask, how do we respond to life in ways that also allow us to be shapers of our lives? I still recall a piece of wisdom that came my way from a gentleman in the first Unitarian Universalist congregation I ever served up in the great state of Maine, a little town up on the coast of Maine, Rockland. He suddenly for him anyway, found his marriage coming apart. We were talking about it after he was trying to make some sense of it all and trying to determine where you go from there. He finally said, in a Maine accent which I will not attempt to imitate, he said, "Well, life deals the cards, but you still got to play the hand." Whatever help I thought I was going to offer him, he gave me a perspective and gave me a metaphor that has stayed with me ever since. It's a perspective which, like many, doesn't hit you all at once. It develops over time. It's a perspective that is gained in the process of the aging and hopefully the maturing process. Around, say, age 18, you figure you're holding most of your life cards, and you have the choice as to how you're going to play them. And in many ways, you do. This is not a false perspective. If a young person didn't feel that way, in fact, as he or she moved into the beginnings of adulthood, then they wouldn't be able to make much of a life for themselves. They wouldn't be able to make any of the life-shaping choices that we make if you didn't feel you held the cards that allowed you to make those choices. If you didn't feel you held a good number of the cards as you emerged from adolescence, then you wouldn't even bother to play them, and your life would be diminished. And yet, life is anything but static. It's not fixed in one place. The perspective shifts. You find out that you're not the only one or the only thing that's doing the dealing. And at some point, maybe in one way or another, you might just find yourself singing along with the Statler Brothers or with Brother Murphy here. But we all thought we'd change the world with our great works and deeds. Or maybe we just thought the world would change to fit our needs. And you discover the truth that living life from day to day is never like it seems. Things get complicated when you get past 18, but the class of 57, or any other year you might want to name, had its dreams. I got to throw in a little sidebar digression here from the late novelist and essayist Kurt Vonnegut. He did a great take on this song. In a collection of his writings called Palm Sunday, he recalled meeting with Don and Harold Reed who actually are the Statler brothers. They wrote the words of the class of 57. Statler brothers, kind of a combination country and gospel quartet. I'm not sure they're even still together, but Kurt Vonnegut writes about how he met the people who wrote this song, and I heard them sing it at somewhere, and here's what he said. "I would actually like to have the class of 57 become our national anthem for a little while. Everybody knows Star Spangled Banner is a bust as music and poetry, and it's as representative as the American spirit as the Taj Mahal." And he goes on, "I can see Americans standing in a grandstand at the Olympics somewhere while one of our athletes wins a medal for the decathlon, say. I can see tears streaming down the singer's cheeks as I get to the line where Mavis finally wound up as anybody's bet." It was such satiric comedy like this that made me delighted to know that Kurt Vonnegut was a fellow Unitarian Universalist for much of his lifetime. In fact, his son Mark, who is now a pediatrician in the Boston area, once considered the UU ministry as a career. Would have made an interesting addition to it. He chose to be a pediatrician instead. Well, Kurt Vonnegut passed away several years ago, but he went on to say that this song could be the anthem of his generation. It could actually be the anthem of most any generation in recent times in America when you think about it, because it's about the various hands we're dealt, even as we attempt to dream our dreams and chart our life journeys. Well, as I noted earlier, it's an ongoing question and debate as to how much of our lives we really choose anyway. I think one of the more obvious and insightful statements made along this line was by the late Protestant theologian Paul Tillich, one of the great theological giants of the 20th century. He said the same thing as my old friend up in Maine said, only in a somewhat more erudite language. Tillich observed that we are creatures of what he called finite freedom. It's this finite freedom that defines our lives. We're born with certain definitions. We're born with certain boundaries attached to us. We're born to certain parents, a certain point in time, particular geographical, social, economic, educational, cultural setting. We're given a race and a gender and a sexual orientation. We're given an arrangement of chromosomes and DNA. How determinative that arrangement is of who we are and what we become is still being explored and debated. But these are all aspects of the finitude into which we're each and all born. Part of the hand we're dealt when we take our first breath of life. Still another of these givens, how ironic as it may be, is a mind that allows us to see any number of possibilities and dreams for ourselves beyond the cards we're dealt. And with this mind is an accompanying sense of freedom that we can pursue these dreams and possibilities. And so our lives then are an ongoing interplay between our finitude, our boundaries, our givens, and the freedom we do possess to operate in tandem with them and try to move beyond those boundaries. That's what I've come to see. Life is really a dance between our finite boundaries and our freedom. Sometimes the freedom leads and sometimes the boundaries lead. And sometimes the lead changes so quickly we don't even know who's doing the leading. It was another major 20th century theologian, Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr, who penned what is well known as the Serenity Prayer. Niebuhr never had anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, but he penned the Serenity Prayer. "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." The story on this is that Dr. Niebuhr wrote this when he was a professor at Union Theological Seminary in New York City, 1932. Union Seminary, one of the great liberal Protestant seminaries of our land. He was giving a sermon at the chapel one week, and one account has that he needed some kind of little concluding line or concluding prayer to wrap up whatever the sermon was, and so he jotted it down just on a piece of paper shortly before delivering his sermon so he'd have some way of putting a period at the end of it. Well, legend and reality is probably one of those cases where they get a little bit mixed together, but that's a good story. And when Alcoholics Anonymous was founded just a few years later, 1936, the founders discovered and adopted Niebuhr's prayer as their mantra. Well, whatever one's theology or lack thereof may be, whether one is dealing with an addiction or not, I still find these rather simple words to be one of the best guideposts for dealing with the dance we all do with the life we're given and the life we dream about. It's on this point where I also find wisdom in the other song that Dan sang for us, let it be. I think I said this a few weeks ago. I had this song sung at my ordination ceremony into the ministry about a little over 40 years ago. For still another part of being in this life dance, which I keep referring to, is knowing when to take the bull by the horns and exert your will. And when you stand back, let the river run and let it be. The wisdom to accept the things I cannot change. The courage to change the things I can. I'm going to make one more pass at Niebuhr. I also find something of an irony in that for all of the weighty volumes of theology he wrote and published during his lifetime, a couple of which I had to struggle through when I was in theological school, that one single sentence is far and away his best known work and his most lasting legacy. I think there's a lesson right there, which is that for all of our efforts, our worthy efforts to be sure to make something of our life and create something lasting, it could just as easily be the simple deed or the words we offer on a whim for which we're best remembered. Well, sometimes in the course of this dance, as I'm calling it, a pretty heavy or sobering or even devastating card or two or three gets thrown down at us. So on that note, I move to the work of another songwriter and poet from whom we heard earlier, and who over much of his rich and full life was especially fond of that life as a dance metaphor. I'm talking about Rick Mastin. Rick passed away nearly 4 years ago, but not until he had spent several years directing the energies of his UU minister and his poet life to working with fellow survivors of prostate cancer. Some of you may remember this. Rick gave a very memorable Sunday morning service here in the fall of 2005. Turned out to be his last, he lives in the California Carmel area, turned out to be his last East Coast tour. And he read some of his cancer poems at that time. I never thought a cancer poem could be uplifting until I heard some of his. And it was during that visit here that Rick and I talked about collaborating on a book about his life and his troubadour ministry within our UU movement. This is what came out of that. I was very happy that he and I were able to get that out and have it released and have a little party for him out in Monterey while he was still living. He died about 4 or 5 months after we launched this book. Well, the poem of his that I read was one of those cancer poems that he wrote in the wake of his diagnosis. And I'm especially taken with the last line, where he quotes Black Eagle, or recites Black Eagle by saying, "Where the easy way crosses the path of difficulty, mark a holy place." Try that again. "Where the easy way crosses the path of difficulty, mark a holy place." Why a holy place where this path of difficulty intersects with the road we're taking? I think the answer is found in the lines just before the Black Eagle quote, where Mr. Mastin tells about being on the phone with someone he calls an anonymous Good Samaritan after he had dialed up a helpline for persons recently diagnosed with cancer. He writes, "The human presence on the other end of the line kept me talking until I remembered everything I know." I love those words. The person Rick reached on the helpline didn't try to tell him what he should do or should think or anything like that. Rather, he kept me talking until I remembered everything I know. What Rick is saying is that when it comes to playing even the most difficult or even devastating of hands, somewhere within us, we have what we need. And he didn't mean this in any kind of a Pollyanna-ish or smiley face kind of a statement. I got to know Rick well enough to know that he's not a Pollyanna or a smiley face kind of a guy. He's certainly cheerful, and he wasn't naive. What he's saying is that we do not completely know the kinds of personal resources we possessed until we're pushed to the point where we have to use them. So whether our strength comes from within us or from beyond us, and as I believe it comes from both locales, we reach a holy place when the nature of that strength is more fully revealed to us. Recall some more of Rick's words. "Once again I remembered that my highest high is in direct proportion to my lowest low. And looking at it this way, there are wonderful times ahead. It has always been in crisis where we find the opportunity to change and grow. Still another irony. Sometimes it's the hand that is dealt us that allows us to discover in return just how much in charge of our lives we are or can be. Well, if I'm going to do a sermon in which I invoke the wise and kindly words of Rick Mastin, a dear friend whom I still dearly miss nearly 4 years after his passing, I have to go with his best known words to conclude this. And actually, you're going to conclude it for me. We'll sing Rick's hymn number 311. We're going to sing together, "Let It Be a Dance." Number 311 in your hymnal.